Welcome to the Full Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy, recording at 1:52 Pacific Standard Time, and today is Friday, the 13th of February. Well, this being Friday, of course, it's the big picture, long-term audio for the various different asset classes. When we go and look at today, then it really, there's no evidence that anyone was really deterred by it being Friday the 13th. The Australian market in particular was up by 2.33%. And when you look at the granularity of that advance, then it is a picture of what's been happening more generally. Well, oil prices have firmed that they had accelerated lower, firmed in the region of $45 odd, and Brent crude, having consolidated, has pushed through to a new rally high above $60. Well, you have a higher high and you have a higher low, and this continues to bear the hallmark of a reversion back towards the mean. Well, the 200-day moving average is currently in the region of approximately $80 and is continuing to decline. So there is additional capacity for some reversion to the mean before we see a major retest of the low, or we see where exactly prices will eventually stabilize. The fact that you've had Rio Tinto come through today with better than expected profits was a boost for the mining sector. And among the top 10 advancers in Australia today, 9 of them were in the mining sector, or at least in the resources or extractive sectors. Well, the energy sector has pulled back so very violently, and the rig count has has pulled back more sharply, in fact, than it did in 2008. And this is, well, a symptom of just how aggressive the cost-cutting has been and the cancelling of projects has been in response to what has been a swinging decline in oil prices since last June. Those companies aren't really going to be rushing to increase their expenditures until they see some kind of evidence that oil prices have stabilized. And well, we're just not there yet, that this is still just a reversionary rally, which is really being sparked by short covering and a bit of bargain hunting. We won't really know where prices have stabilized until we see a more substantive test of the low. And that could take, well, it could take a while. Well, when we go and then look at one of the other reasons that the Australian market has been doing well has been the resilience of the banking sector. That's been encouraged by the fact that the Australian dollar has been so weak. And part of the reason that it has been so weak is because the RBA has been lowering interest rates. Well, lower energy prices, lower commodity prices are a potential problem for a country like Australia, and they feel the need that they have to stimulate. But what we're also seeing is that in here today that Sweden introduced a negative interest rate of 0.1%, that Denmark is intervening rather heavily in the currency markets in order to sustain its peg with the euro. The ECB is on the cusp of a purchase program in the order of 60 billion euros a month, which will take its balance sheet back up to 3 trillion euros, or an increase of 50% over the next 18 months. And despite the fact that we've been through years of quantitative easing from various central banks, a trillion euros is still a lot of money. Lower energy prices, lower commodity prices are affecting the inflationary measures of a number of central banks. Some of them are obviously panicking and feeling that they really need to introduce extraordinary measures to stimulate inflation. Well, one of the reasons for that is because despite the fact that we would characterize this fall in commodity prices as disinflationary, and they would characterize it as deflationary, the argument is rather academic when one has a stock of outstanding debt that one was hoping to inflate away. Well, that's very much the case for a number of central banks, so they're a little bit panicky. They need to stimulate, they need to increase the inflation measures that they've got. When we look at how did quantitative easing programs end in countries like the UK, that the size of the Bank of England's balance sheet did not go down, but it merely stabilized. In other words, they just reinvested all of their dividends, or well, all of their coupons and maturing debt. When we consider just how strong the US dollar has been, or how weak just about any other currency one wishes to compare it against have been, then the prospect of the Federal Reserve reducing the size of its balance sheet is pretty remote. When we cast the net a little bit wider and start looking at other stock markets and other central banks, then India, for example, is really perhaps one of the countries that would benefit most from lower energy prices in particular, and that leaves the central bank with ample room to reduce interest rates. Well, if they don't have the inflationary pressures, then they don't have to have such high interest rates. A very similar story for China. And of course, Japan has been engaged in quantitative easing for a number of years now, and there's no prospect of that ending either. We take all of that together, and what we are presented with is a liquidity-fueled market. We've characterized the rally on Wall Street over the last number of years as a liquidity-fueled environment. It's taken the stock market up very considerably, and there is now this, well, one could say, a very heated debate about just what the valuations are like. Well, there's no argument that they were undervalued in 2008 and 2009, and some people are worried today that they are overvalued. Well, if one looks at the PE of something like Facebook, where it's still in the order of 40, then you don't have to go too far. Or if you look at, for example, Tesla, where the PE is just very, very high indeed. However, if you start looking at major corporations and their cash balances, and you kind of back out that cash, then it would be difficult to say that Apple is an expensive stock. So when you have had a move like we've had over the last number of years, then it does take, I think, benefit from taking a little bit more of a liberal view as to exactly where we are, and really looking at where the consistency of the trend is. Because on the fundamental side, we could have really an endless argument about where we are in terms of valuations, but as long as we're presented with consistent trends, then consistent trends are trends in motion, and that ranges have been relatively similar sized, of a similar duration, and they continue to be resolved to the upside. And we could again have a long argument about the effectiveness of quantitative easing on reigniting growth in various markets, and the evidence is pretty thin that it's effective in that regard, but it is highly effective in inflating asset prices, and not least in nominal terms. We've had a great deal of asset price inflation in the US. That the prospect of €1 trillion being printed in Europe is contributing to the outperformance of those markets in nominal terms at present. And that's likely to continue, I suspect, for at least as long as the quantitative easing program lasts. But that the competitive devaluation that we're getting in the currency markets, that the predictable volatility that was likely to creep into the currency markets, not least when Japan initiated its currency devaluation program and put such pressure on its neighbors, that this isn't something that is likely to ease, and that in past events when we've had major moves in currencies, then you really need multilateral intervention, and at the present time there's no call for it. There isn't any real incentive for any country to really engage in any kind of measure to support their currencies, that they are wholly acting in their own self-interest and supporting their export sectors. And that's all contributing to nominal price inflation. Well, when just about every country is printing their fiat currency, then that's generally very positive for the stock market. And well, stocks will likely have a solid record of keeping pace with inflation in that regard. Well, precious metal prices have been in the doldrums for the last 2 years, and gold had a failed downside break only 2 months ago and is continuing to rally up towards the upper side of its range. Well, when we look at the chart seminar and a failed downside break, a rule of thumb is that when the dynamic of the failure is larger than the dynamic of the breakdown, that it will go back up and test the upper side of the range. Well, with gold, that's around $1,400. Gold prices at the current point are at $1,229. So there is, well, who's to say that they will get to $1,400, but the likelihood is increasing that they will go up from here as currency prices come down. That gold, if you look at it in terms of a currency, that it has obvious attraction in an environment where interest rates are going to zero and below. And as an instrument that doesn't have a yield, the lower the interest rate is, the more positive it is for gold. Well, silver was a little bit weaker today. Sorry, I'm looking at the wrong thing. Silver was up by 53 cents today. It's back above $17. It was, well, it's been volatile over the last number of months. Having got all the way up to 1850, it came back down to 1650, and it's back above $17 in here today. Well, we can regard the low around 1650 as a higher reaction low within the context of what has been a 3 to 4 month bottoming process. Palladium, which has been really the main outperformer within the precious metal sector, has firmed up again from the lower side of its range. It's been ranging really for the last 4 months above $750, and given the background that we have in just macroeconomics, that it's unlikely to go below $750 in this environment. Well, the precious metal sector has been out of fashion, and part of the reason for that is because the stock markets have just been a bit more attractive. Well, they have the potential to at least perform in line over the next year as all of these central banks are just engaged in increasing the supply of money. Well, we're at an interesting situation in Europe, and that that good quality or dividend paying stocks yield more than their respective governments. And that it was the same situation in the USA in 2010. In fact, for a very brief period, 2 weeks ago, that's exactly what we had in the US, where the US 10-year treasury was yielding less than the stock market. Well, you've had a pullback in prices and a pop in yields for the US treasury, so you don't have that situation anymore. But with the Bund currently trading in sub 1% level, then the attraction of being in the stock market when you're really getting a yield that even in a disinflationary environment is unattractive, where, well, 10-year bonds yield about a third of 1%, and the DAX index, I'm just waiting for the level to come up, the DAX index yields 2.49%. Well, you look at some of the companies that have got reasonably good records of paying out dividends and the potential for asset price inflation in Europe to close at least partially that yield gap is really very high. Well, then if you're thinking about that, then you have to take a view on exactly where the euro is likely to go. The euro is not a strong currency. Well, you might kind of guffaw at that because it has been so very weak. The euro has fallen from 140 to almost 110 versus the dollar over the last 7 or 8 months. it's really incredibly overextended relative to the 200-day moving average. There is this big debate going on as to whether Greece is going to stay with the euro or not, or whether they're going to be ejected from it. That's still very much open to question. I guess the reality is that for Greece to remain within the eurozone, it's going to need some form of concession. And in the absence of a concession, it's pretty hard to imagine how it is going to be able to remain within the euro. That the demands that have been put on the Greek population are such that it will get to the point of civil war if you do not get some form of concession coming through. This isn't a situation that Europe has had to deal with previously. It's ill prepared for it. You could argue that it's their own fault for not really engaging in better planning. But at the present moment, the euro is oversold, and it's at least unwinding part of that oversold condition. That there is still potential for an additional unwind. It means that the immediate need for a hedge on Europe is probably not as much as it has been over the last 6 months, but that if it gets up towards 120, that would probably be a more opportune time to be putting on hedges. The risk-adjusted way of engaging with Europe at the present moment would be to have a hedge, if one was to take a medium-term view. If Europe is going to print a trillion euros and the USA is going to remain pat, then the potential for the euro to weaken beyond where it has already found support, I'd say, is better than even. Therefore, in an environment where we have this competitive devaluation and where volatility in currencies has increased substantially and certainly greater than anything that we've seen in the last decade, then the need to hedge that currency exposure is, I think, it looks like a sound piece of advice. And that's particularly the case when interest rates are so very low. Now, it won't always be this inexpensive to have a hedge, but it's very inexpensive right now, where interest rates are basically nothing. So then the question is, what do you lose by having a hedge? And the answer is really not very much. Well, when we go and think about this in terms of the big picture, that there are these major themes that are unfolding, that you have the rise of the global middle class, and that's being facilitated by improving governance. A big population on its own is a headwind, but a big population where governance is improving to such an extent that it is allowing people to unlock their productive capacity, well, that's powerfully bullish. When you have a technology sector where innovation is increasing, well, what you have is this handy way of talking about it, is the Internet of Everything, the Internet of Things, that transmitting capacity, diagnostic capacity, and chips are being put into just about everything, so that computers get to talk to each other, that we get much more information back from our machinery, that it will allow the useful life of machinery to increase and diagnostics to occur to thin out supply chains and contribute to efficiency gains. Well, perhaps more important than that is that we're in a global economy, so that innovation in one piece of technology can be distributed globally almost instantly. So we have technological innovation, we have technological availability, but the pace of the advance in technology is perhaps even more important again, because, well, if we were to talk about 3D printing 10 years ago, that would have been enough to spark the interest in a secular bull market. If we were to talk about the Internet of Everything, then that would also have been the spark for a major move. When you talk about the enhancements in biotechnology, then you have the a potential for another bull market. But what we're getting at present is that all of these things are happening together, and that one piece of, or an enhancement in one area of the technology field is fueling innovation elsewhere else, or elsewhere. So you can get a 3D printer which can print an esophagus, or a trachea, or a bladder, or a kidney. That we're quite quickly entering the area of personalized medicine, and that will likely be facilitated by the fact that your mobile phone is going to become your health assistant. That the wearables market is really only just beginning, and that the release of the Apple Watch in the next couple of months could potentially be a very big deal indeed. Well, not just for Apple, but from the perspective of personal data acquisition, and particularly for the health field. Well, these are just incredibly powerful themes, so that we have lots of people, and that they're going to be provided with just powerfully innovative tools. And the energy used to fuel all of these things is getting cheaper. Well, we've been banging the drum for unconventional oil and gas now for really quite a long time. And that is, to a certain extent, now already in the price. That everybody knows about it, that it's well accepted, and that where it can be implemented, it is being implemented. And that has resulted in lower energy prices, occurring in a very swift period of time. Well, what we also have is that solar is really a technology. And if it's a technology, then Moore's Law is applicable, so that the cost and efficiency of solar cells is improving all the time. Well, we're not that far away from where the efficiencies that can be currently got in the lab will become useful pieces of technology that you can have in your house, and will far outstrip anything that has already been installed. Well, that means that the availability of energy is no longer likely to be a concern. Well, if energy becomes both abundant and cheap, then the types of activities that one might not have been able to do because energy was expensive suddenly become possible. Well, it's just the same the other way around. It's that the energy that wasn't possible to extract when prices were very low becomes highly possible at higher prices. That's one of the reasons that we've had the increase in supply. Well, it works exactly the same for demand. So when energy prices are low, we're going to find new ways to use it. And that's going to contribute to economic growth. Well, when you have these major themes coming true, and then you also have the liquidity-fueled environment that we've got, then you have the prospect of additional asset price inflation. Well, when we think about the bond market, people are worried about deflation, but they're not as worried about deflation at the present time, since yields are so remarkably low that we're getting mean reversion in yields at the present moment. But we're still a long way from the kinds of yields that will inhibit the expansion of the stock market. In fact, the way yields are at the moment, they couldn't probably be more positive for the stock market. Well, I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend. And I wish all the best to all of you.